Hi, I'm Susan Lewis. I had the chance to talk with Rachel Barton Pine about her recording of the violin concertos of Elgar and Bruch. I asked her why she chose to put these two particular concertos together.
You know, when I thought about recording each of them, I somehow felt like they belonged together, first of all, sort of humorously. Of the major romantic concertos, the Bruch is pretty much the shortest and the Elgar is pretty much the longest. But more importantly, there's something very personal about each of them. The Bruch and Elgar are very human concertos. They're passionate, they're intimate. The kind of sound that you want to get out of the violin is very similar for each of them, very warm and lush and rich. And so somehow I felt like they would really belong together, even though they were written 40 years apart in different countries.
That's cool. Well, could we start with the Bruch? You learned it when you were just 8 years old.
Yeah, so basically when, you know, little kids are growing up playing concertos, you know, there's a number of student concertos, and then you do your basic Baroque and classical period initial pieces, you know, a little Vivaldi, a little Mozart, and then the Bruch or Mendelssohn is typically the first romantic grown-up concerto that you're given, and sometimes it's one, sometimes it's the other. So for me, it was the Bruch, and I started my journey with it at age 8, and then I first soloed it with the Chicago Symphony when I was 11, and I've played it countless times since then, whereas the Elgar I never did learn during my student years because it's just off the beaten track enough that it wasn't one of those ones that you have to study to have your full repertoire to start your career with. But luckily, I was invited to play it at the beginning of my young adult years, and I've played it a handful of times since, not as often as I would love to do. It's kind of a catch-22 where it's not programmed as much because audiences don't know it as well, and so therefore audiences don't ever get to know it as well, and you remain stuck in this rut. So I'm hoping that my album will help contribute to audiences actually getting to know it better, and maybe I'll get to play it more often. But I have played it often enough over the years to really feel an affinity for it, and it was definitely on my wish list of albums to make.
That's great. Well, one of the things that jumped out at me in your materials in connection with this CD was that the Bruch was an ideal piece, you thought, to introduce people new to classical music, to the genre. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so, you know, when I'm demonstrating, I'll use the opening cadenza, meaning, you know, right after the few-measure orchestral start to the piece, the violin plays a little statement unaccompanied. And it's interesting to show how, you know, classical after the Baroque period doesn't have the kind of improvisation where you're adding notes or ornaments or things like that. You're playing what the composer wrote. But nonetheless, you have a lot of room for extemporizing or for personalizing your interpretation. And so I'll play the cadenza as written, the rhythms on the page, and then I'll show how you would never actually perform it that way and play it, you know, five different ways, showing how you can make it a little louder, a little softer, speed up, slow down, choose different fingerings, different tone colors. And so what we do with the music is really our classical improvisation, and that's really fun to sort of let people know about. But I think in the Bruch especially, the feelings of each movement are very, very vividly drawn. I'll often use it in schools as, you know, some of my excerpts to show people about the emotions of music. So the first movement, I'll ask kids, you know, for the main theme, you know, what does it sound like? And they'll say strong or angry, things like that. And the last movement, they often say it sounds triumphant or joyful. You can really hear it. And the second movement is, I describe it as epic. It's just, it goes from the most delicate moments to the most, you know, overwhelming cathartic moments, and it almost sounds like, not that it's in that Hollywood type of sound, but it sounds like it could be telling a story, something very, very dramatic that you might think of as a movie scene or something like that. I actually even use it on my program when I mix classical and rock music, because even though it doesn't have a rock music sound, it's somehow just this very powerful, very grand type of statement that rock fans can really relate to.
Right. Well, going back to the cadenza, when you described that that's an example of the way classical musicians improvise, when you make a recording, what kind of choices do you have to make?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I consider recording sessions to be such a different art form than performance. It's like if you really want to hear me play a piece, you got to go hear me play it live. But I also love the fact that a recording can share my music with people who haven't had a chance to hear me live or preserve it for posterity. Because in a performance, you can have so much spontaneity where you often do something that you could practice for 100 hours and you never thought of it until that moment on stage. And it has to do with just the inspiration of the vibe of the audience coming back at you.
Right.
You know, if you were performing for no one, that wouldn't happen. But, you know, with the audience there experiencing it, you know, I always feel like audiences are not just mere observers, but they're participating somehow. On the other hand, in a recording, you can actually capture your ideal thoughts in a way that you never can on stage. Even a perfect performance where there were, you know, where every note was in tune and there were no scratches and there's nothing wrong with a performance and it was heartfelt and everything. Nonetheless, if you play something in the studio three times, you can then choose the most beautiful of this phrase and put it next to the most beautiful of that phrase and get something that's almost like inhuman that you could never play at that beautifully live because no human could, but yet it's not fake or anything like that because what you're capturing is you're capturing what's inside you, what your thoughts are about the piece is being put there on album. And so, you know, that's so you're not going to have any spontaneous new thoughts, but you're definitely going to be able to most fully capture the thoughts you have, even more so than you would on stage. But you do have to, as you said, make decisions and say, okay, this is how I'm going to do it today, and I'll do it, you know, five times like that, so that the engineers have something to work with.
So when you look back on a recording, for example, you may say, wow, that's interesting. I mean, does it sometimes surprise you the way you interpreted something?
When I go back to my earliest albums, certainly I feel like I've progressed quite a lot as an artist. Some of it has to do with just my musical journey and deeper understanding of certain composers and having played that music a lot more than however many years ago I recorded it. But what's interesting is there are some pieces that I go back to an album I made 20 years ago and I still feel like it's not uncurrent, you know, it still right. is what I think about it. And other things I say, well, that sounded good for the old me, but that's not how I would do it today, you right. know, but I'm still proud of what I did at the time. And so I have to always warn conductors for certain pieces if they get my album and then think that that's how I'm going to perform it. It's like, no. I mean, why don't you wait and hear me play it for you? Because I've changed it a little.
Right. When you share this kind of music with people, especially young people or people new to classical music, do you also consider Brooks' life at the time?
Well, I think, you know, you always need to know a little bit about the musicians that wrote the music. It's like a collaboration between you and the composer, even if the composer is dead. And, you know, the music speaks for itself and you have to rely on your instincts, but to have some historic knowledge about the composer's own personality, about the time and place and performance traditions that the composer came from, and also the violinist for whom it was written and what their musical personality was, can often lend you a lot of insights about how the music ought to be played. And then you have to kind of marry that with your own personal feelings about it. Brooke, it wasn't as much of anything specific going on in his life that particular year, but more about just his general musical personality. And he was a bit of a curmudgeon, kind of a conservative. You know, he didn't like all these newfangled tone poems and things. But nonetheless, you know, I think he was a very sincere person. And you can hear that in this music. It's just the best of German mid-romanticism, you know, absolutely gorgeous. And it was written for Joachim, and I had the opportunity to study in Berlin at the end of my student years with an old professor from East Berlin who was a student of Joachim. And so I really got some insights into this whole Brahms tradition. Elgar, on the other hand, his concerto has one of his typical mysterious dedications. It says, "Herein is enshrined the soul of dot, 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 dot." And so it's a musical portrait of someone, and there's speculation about which lady in his life he might have meant. And so you do have to actually get into Elgar's personal love life a bit and figure out where he was coming from. And
I understand you worked with Sir Neville Mariner on this before he died, and his teacher collaborated with Elgar. So what kind of stories did you learn?
Yeah, so, you know, definitely just understanding about, you know, sort of the poetry of the piece and things like that. But there's just a, you know, fun scene that Elgar's collaborator, Billy Reed, it wasn't written for him, it was written for Fritz Kreisler, but Billy Reed was the violinist that Elgar was actually consulting with a number of times during its creation. So Billy Reed was the one heavily involved in the concerto reaching its final form, and then it was just simply handed over to Kreisler. So Elgar would have all these different versions of how he wanted passages to go, and he would tape them up on, you know, on the walls and set them on the back of chairs and up on the mantelpiece, and Billy Reed would walk around the room playing this version and that version and all the options, and then Elgar would get really excited and decide which one he liked best, and Billy Reed would give him some suggestions. And that's just such a vivid scene to think of, the composer walking around the room with all these bits of manuscript paper all over the wall. And what it tells you is that there's such a level of detail in the score. It's very, very dense, whereas Brooke leaves a lot to the interpreter. Elgar is, I don't want to say dictatorial, but he's much more detailed in his instructions to the violinist, including which string you should play certain passages on, even when it's not intuitive to do so. He obviously was going for a certain sound or a certain emotional effect. And knowing the story of how he came to all of those decisions really makes you feel like you should respect them and try your best to honor them and not just play it the way that seems more comfortable to you, but try to figure out how to actually do what Elgar is asking you to do, because he really meant it.
Any particular parts of that concerto that engage you especially?
Well, the second movement is so tender. In fact, one of the themes, Elgar requested that it be engraved on his tombstone. This was actually one of, this whole concerto was one of his favorites of his own works. And so
the music engraved?
Yes, yes, a little musical quote.
Wow.
So, yeah, very, very interesting. And yeah, so I think that the second movement just feels, you know, so loving, and you know, it just, it's comforting. This is like, you know, the musical equivalent of comfort food, both of these concertos.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.